Welcome to this portion of Vocal Point. I'm Jerry Newcomb, and right now we're going to talk with John Eidsmo, who is a law professor. He's been serving as a law teacher for many, many years. He also is senior counsel at the Foundation for Moral Law, which was established by former Chief Justice Roy Moore of the Alabama Supreme Court. John Eidsmo has written several books. His most famous is probably Christianity and the Constitution, but now he's written a three-part series called Historical and Theological Foundations of Law. John Eidsmo, so good to have you back on the program.
Jerry, it's always good to be with you. You do such a wonderful job of getting the word out to people, as well as your own books.
Well, you're very kind. All right, so tell us about this three-part series. What is it, and why did you decide to write it?
Historical and Theological Foundations of Law, the basic issue that confronts law not only in America, but throughout the world and throughout history, is simply this. Is law simply the will of the king, the parliament, the government, whoever has the muscle to make a rule and force it on people? Or does law reflect a higher reality, the law of God? And what I've demonstrated in this book, going through ancient societies, going through the Bible, going through the development of the common law, the Lutheran and Calvinist reformations, on through Blackstone and on into the American colonies, is that almost everyone throughout all history has recognized that their laws come from some higher source, whether it's God or the gods or the Tao or whatever they wish to call it. The idea that law is simply man-made and that law is an evolutionary process going from the simple to the complex is a modern aberration.
What's interesting about that, too, when you mention evolution, if evolution were true, unguided, you know, nothing to do with God type processes, natural processes, how is it that law would even evolve in the first place and then law would be consistent? It really is illogical when you think about it.
Well, it certainly is. The idea that people can develop their own laws and that those laws become more complex as people evolve and that laws as a result get more sophisticated and better as they move from the primitive to the civilized. In fact, we see the opposite trend in many instances. We see law going from being a very enlightened system in earlier times, like that of the Babylonians, to degenerating into tyranny, degenerating into a denial of human rights and the like. One thing that law does, and this seems to be a continuous process, almost universal, is that government has a tendency to centralize over time, that law has a tendency to multiply. In other words, the more time goes on, the greater number of laws there are. That doesn't mean better, certainly.
Mm-hmm.
But when we look to these ancient societies and we see how they reflect a higher reality, that doesn't mean that Odin or Marduk or the gods of these people believe in gave them their laws. Rather, what I suggest is that they are echoes of Eden, echoes of what God originally gave us in his law, the law that is written on men's hearts, and a law that all men have in their hearts, but that gets distorted and that gets forgotten through time. And, of course, the best system of all of these is the one that God gave not only by natural revelation or natural law, the law written on men's hearts. The best is what God gave us in his revealed word, the Mosaic law, the laws not only of Moses, but the Noahide, or the laws given in the covenant God made with Noah, those that come by his special revelation through the word.
Well, you know, it's interesting. G.K. Chesterton once said, if men will not be governed by the Ten Commandments, they'll be governed by the 10,000 commandments. And I think in some ways that echoes what you had just said about how we're making more and more laws these days, but we're not necessarily improving. But going back to what I was saying about evolution, if evolution were true, how is it that the law of gravity would just evolve to a place where it is a fixed law? You know, and maybe somebody could say, well, somewhere in, you know, some other universe or something, the law of gravity doesn't apply. But the law of gravity does apply where we are. And, you know, if you think otherwise, then jump off the Empire State Building and, you know, good luck with that. I mean, It is an amazing reality of natural law that there is such a thing as laws, the laws of nature and of nature's God.
You're making a comparison there between the physical and chemical and mathematical laws that govern the universe and moral laws for the governance of man. But that equation has been made throughout history. Blackstone, Montesquieu, others talk about this. In fact, Montesquieu talks about this law of nature that makes the planets circulate as they do, that provides that 2 + 2 always equals 4, and that's going to be true here and in China and in the next galaxy and 1,000 years from now. But then he goes on to say that, well, nature obeys the laws of nature perfectly. The intelligent part of creation, by which I assume he means us, although sometimes I might question that, the intelligent part of creation does not obey the law of nature as fully as nature itself does. And he said two reasons for this. One, our understanding is limited. We don't always understand the law of nature. And number two, that because of our depraved nature, the fall, we don't even obey the parts of the law we do understand many times. And so he said that's why man needs government, and that's why man needs parliaments and the like to pass laws and to enforce them, and understanding that these are not going to be perfect, but understand that they are man's imperfect attempt to take the law of God and apply it to the world in which we live.
Well, but the part of the reason I'm even asking about this is we live in such a day of lawlessness. Even among church members today, even some professing evangelicals, you find what we could call antinomianism. The idea, you know, if you bring up the Ten Commandments among some Christian circles and they say, oh, that's Old Testament, that's law, we're under grace. And that is a concept that I'm sure Paul the Apostle would not have agreed with.
Well, and yet Paul, of course, says that we are not under law, but under grace. And for people like you and me, Jerry, we believe in the inspired and inerrant Word of God. If Paul says that, it must be true.
Right.
The question is, what does he mean by it?
Sure.
And most people who would say that we are not under law, but under grace, aren't going to live as though the law has no application at all. Most people who say they're living under grace don't go out and murder and steal and do all sorts of things like that. And so, obviously, they don't think the law is irrelevant. And sometimes I think people in that camp really fail to fully understand and articulate exactly what Paul means by this. When Paul says we're not under law but under grace, here's what I suggest he means. I'm going to give you five things that I think Paul is saying here. Number one, I think he means we're not under the condemnation of the law, because Christ has paid the penalty for us.
Okay. For those who believe.
Mm-hmm. For those who believe, of course. And number two, I think he means that we're not under the law as a means of salvation. Now, we never were. Even in the Old Testament era, we were saved by grace, and as the Hebrew looked to the sacrifices on the altar, he saw in those sacrifices a type or picture of Christ dying on the cross for us, and we read that Abraham believed God, and it was counted unto him for righteousness. We read Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. But in Paul's time, some had distorted the law into a means of salvation, and Paul was correcting that. Third thing I think he means is we're not under the ceremonial aspects of the law, you know, the sacrifices, the feasts, and the various dress requirements and things like this. And these are valuable today for teaching purposes many times, but those are part of the covenant God made with Moses, and we're not obliged to keep the ceremonial law today. Mm-hmm. Fourth, I think he is saying we're not under extra-biblical law, the laws that you find in the Talmud for the Jews and so on, or some of the extra-biblical taboos that we develop in our society, some of which may have a good purpose, but we're not under them as covenant obligation. Finally, we're not under them in covenant obligation quite the same as the Jews were. It's kind of like, well, I'm from Alabama, and we have a speed limit of 70 miles an hour here in Alabama, but recently I was out in Montana, and the last time I'd been in Montana before, they had no speed limit. I understood they developed a speed limit shortly after I was there. I don't think my being there had any connection with that. But at any rate, when I got out there now, the speed limit is now 85. But if I'm out there in the interstate in Montana and the speed limit is 85, would I say, nope, but I'm from Alabama, and so I'm under the 70-mile speed limit? No. When I'm not in Alabama, I'm not under Alabama law. And in the same way, I would say we're not under the Mosaic law as covenant obligation. And now, granted, some may disagree with that. But I think that's what Paul is saying when he says we're not under law, but under grace. But, you know, right after he says that, he goes on to say, what then? What shall we say then? Shall we sin more that grace may abound? God forbid.
Right.
There were actually people in those days, the ones you just described, the antinomians, who against law or no law, who were saying that, well, grace is a good thing, right? Okay, well, if grace is a good thing, then the more sin there is, the more grace there is going to be, and so we should sin more because that produces more grace. And Paul says, God forbid. And he says, the law is holy, and the commandment is holy, just, and good. In other words, the law reflects the character of God. It reflects the will of God. And that being the case, there is a value to law today. And that value in law today was well articulated by both John Calvin and Martin Luther. I won't get into the issue at length here as to whether Luther believed in the third use of the law. Suffice it to say that I believe in my chapter on Luther, I have thoroughly refuted the notion of some that Luther didn't believe in the third use. But the first use of the law, the civil use, is the civil government taking the law and making it into a prohibition so that even though it doesn't take away our desire to sin, yet crime doesn't pay, and so it causes people to decide that it isn't worth it to sin. If I think about stealing out of a jewelry store, for example, and I think, well, that I'll get caught and I'll get put in jail, so crime doesn't pay, it's just not worth it. And the civil use of the law is what enables us to live together, believers and unbelievers alike, in a civil society where we are not murdering each other and stealing from each other and the like. And so the civil use, we sometimes call that the curb, that is, the barrier, the protection. The rule is the second use, the teaching use of the law, by which the law shows us the eternal character of God, the perfection of his law, and shows us how, by comparison, we don't measure up, and therefore it drives us to the foot of the cross. Hmm. When God sets forth these commandments, and as we see, be ye therefore perfect, even as your Father in heaven is perfect, and even unless your righteousness exceed that of the scribes and the Pharisees, when we see what the law really is and its perfect character like this, we know we don't measure up, and so that drives us to the foot of the cross. That's the second use. It convicts us of sin. Sometimes I put it this way. The law cannot save us, but the law is instrumental in our salvation. Because without the law, we can't know that we're sinners. And if we don't know we're sinners, we can't know that we need salvation through Jesus Christ. And then the third use of the law, also a form of the teaching law, but this for believers, is where we, as believers, as we're working towards spiritual maturity, sanctification as we call it, the law gives us a measure by which we can see the mind of Christ, by which we can see the character of God and the will of God, and which by the power of the Holy Spirit and the Word working in our hearts, we can conform our lives increasingly to the character of Jesus Christ. And so we sometimes call those three uses of the law the curb, the rule, and the mirror. The curb, that is the barrier to cause us to decide that sinning just isn't worth the penalty. The rule, that is the measure by which we see God's standard and we measure ourselves and see that we don't stand up. The mirror by which we look into the mirror of the law and see what our lives should be.
Mm-hmm.
And
we're basically out of time, but I would definitely like to have you to talk further about how law is important and for us to understand it historically and even in terms of why it's relevant today. Again, the book that we're talking about is actually three books, Historical and Theological Foundations of Law by John Eidsmo, law professor extraordinaire, morallaw.org for more information. John, thanks so much for being with us.
And thank you, Jerry. It's always a pleasure.
All right, God bless.
Do it again.
Sure, thanks. Bye-bye.